All right. More on tree architecture. Okay. So fortunately, most of my introduction slides have already been covered. And a lot of what I'm going to show is actually going to mirror what Kanong just talked about, but it's going to be in prunus and mostly in peach trees. I know in the title I had talked, mentioned breeding. I'm not actually going to talk much about breeding. Our program has been breeding for different tree architectures in peach for decades. This was work done by Ralph Scorza, who retired a couple of years ago. He had released a couple selections of more upright forms, a Crimson Rocket, Sweeten Up, a Nectarine. So those were available. Fruit size is maybe a little small, still have some disease resistance problems. But otherwise, we think in the future, this shows great promise. One of the things we were running up against was really knowledge about what exactly we were breeding for and what the potential effects would be. So, for example, in our upright forms, like I mentioned, we had smaller fruit size. Is that a consequence of those genetic changes, or was it just something that was linked? We didn't really know. So we undertook a project about 7 or 8 years ago to really start trying to dig in to better understand the sort of genetics and the molecular biology behind tree architecture. So aside from a lot of the introduction about why this is important, I'll just point out, this is just a picture in maize, how important modifications to plant architecture have been for agriculture. So in field crops, changes in architecture have led to dramatic improvements in the density of crop planting and the productivity. So the ability to feed people, the billions of people we have on the planet now, has been in part due to changes in architecture. And we saw that in the Green Revolution with the dwarf wheat varieties and that sort of thing. So this has been certainly very important. In trees, genetically, we haven't really changed them very much. There's a number of reasons for this. Obviously, breeding trees is much more difficult. So what we're doing now, isn't all that different. But this is now, as you've seen in these other talks, is changing very quickly in terms of how things are done, except we're not wearing a shirt and ties anymore when we harvest in the field. So, and obviously, this is important for a number of reasons, for sustainability and all the other things that have already been talked about. So the question then becomes, can we change these things genetically? When we talk about architecture, we're talking about a whole lot of different physiological and genetic parameters. So there's all kinds of things. This is not an exhaustive list of all the different tropisms and apical control, apical dominance. It's a very complex thing. And when we started this, one question we had was, how much of this is going to be unique to trees and how much can be done in model systems? So I'll try to go through that a little bit and you'll get some idea of what we're finding. But in general, our hope is that by understanding these processes better, it will not only inform our breeding, but also our horticultural manipulations as well. So one of the things that I've been very interested in is of the phenomena that's involved in tree architecture is this thing called apical control. So we know about apical dominance, the ability of the apical shoot to control the bud break below it. Apical control works across the entire tree. So it's the effect the apical shoot has on lateral branches at distal places in the tree. And you see this in a classic sort of Christmas tree shape where you have these short, more vertically oriented shoots at the top, and then they get flatter, more horizontal and wider at the bottom. So this is something that we really don't know much about, partly because it's difficult to study in model systems where a lot of our work has been done. But I'm going to come back to this because this is really a central question that in the project that Kanong and I have been working on that was funded through NSF, this was something we really were trying to get a handle on is some of the physiology and genetics that are behind that. So again, in peach, the way we approach this is very similar to what Kanong had mentioned in apple. We're working with these, what we call pillar. It's very similar to a columnar. And weeping forms. We have other tree architectures as well that I'm not going to talk about today that we've mapped some of those genes as well. But one of the things that I was interested in was in these forms, we see changes in the lateral branch behavior. So we're very interested in why this is. How do these branches orient themselves? How do they know which direction they're going? And how is that being controlled throughout the tree? These mutants in some way have some influence or changes in this concept of apical control. So one of the things that we discovered through trying to identify these genes, and we now know what the pillar and weeping genes are. In the case of the pillar trees, we discovered that it was controlled by a gene called TAC1. And so this is a protein of unknown function. The only thing we could find similar was a gene that was identified in rice that had a similar effect, and I'll show that in a second. But it seems to have this dramatic effect on branch orientation. When you knock it out, the branches all grow vertically. Now, in studying that sequence, we also identified it was part of a family of genes. Their sequences are very divergent, so this is not obvious. There are certain domains that are conserved that allow us to see this. But this other group of genes is the lazy and also DRO genes. So there's some now, the literature on this is a bit confused because people have been giving them different names. But we're going to just kind of refer them as the lazy family. And this is one of the genes that Kanong had mentioned that showed up in his weeping locus. So these genes also control branch orientation as well. So it looks like we have this family of genes that are all involved in helping the tree set or establish its sort of orientation and growth structure. So as I noted at the bottom, most plant genomes have a single TAC1 gene, unless they've had recent duplications. You'll see multiple copies. The lazy DRO family, and DRO is a gene that influences the roots. We now know that some of those members also influence the shoot. We see somewhere between 4 and 6 copies typically in a genome. So not a big gene family, but they appear to be very important. So we were able to manipulate these in plum. You'll see the lazy mutant, just like Kanong had showed in apple, has these horizontal branches. While the TAC1 have these vertical branches. And I'll just show you a couple pictures here. So this is what we get in Arabidopsis. So the point I mentioned before about can we use model systems to study tree architecture, in this case it looks like we can. And so we've been doing this quite a bit now because, surprisingly enough, it worked out. Now, these weren't necessarily identified in Arabidopsis initially, so it wasn't a good system per se to study it from the outset, but working backward, we can kind of discover these phenotypes. And then in rice as well. So you can see that this TAC1 gene in rice, and this is something that had already been bred in most of the cultivated varieties, simply for the reason that you can plant a higher density. I could show a picture of maize as well. Same situation, upright leaf angles, again, in modern maize varieties is due to changes in the TAC1 gene as well. Now, this is something that's fairly new that came from Yoshihara. This is out of Edgar Spalding's group, I think, in Wisconsin, and also another group in Japan published about the same time. These lazy genes have these additive effects. So the top set of images there show the Arabidopsis seeds grown on plates oriented vertically. So the roots grow down, the shoots grow up. And this was Jessica Guzman, a postdoc in my lab, who just got these seeds and grew these out. So I took a picture because they're cool. So in a single mutant, you can see both in the shoot and the roots, we get these nice horizontal growth patterns of the lateral roots and shoots. So this is, again, a lazy one mutant. If we add another family member, you get a little more severe of a phenotype where now the lateral roots are starting to grow up a little bit, and the lateral shoots are now growing a little more down. In the triple mutant, the polarity of the plant is completely reversed. So the shoots grow down, the roots grow up, and, well, thank you. So here you can see the roots growing vertically, and the shoots, plant is upside down, essentially. So this is really, really, really incredible. I mean, I think these genes are really probably some of the most important family of genes that's been identified in terms of plant body plan and their role in it in quite some time. And it turns out that they act upstream of auxin. So in these mutants, this is a wild type. What will happen is if you reorient a plant, you'll get this auxin polarity that forms that essentially tells the plant, which way to bend in response to gravity. So in these mutants, if you look at a lazy one mutant, you kind of just lose the polarity so that the plant doesn't really ever respond to gravity. It just doesn't bend. In these triple mutants, what happens is the plant is actually going the opposite direction. So the polarity is now upside down. So you get this dramatic change in its growth habit. Now, this has been great, but one of the problems is we still have no idea what these proteins do. So they have this important role. We kind of can place them in the pathway a little bit, but we're not clear on exactly how they're functioning. Okay. So from this strategy of genetically identifying the genes, what we've run into are unknown proteins, and this is obviously going to be a long-term effort to try to understand how this is all working. We are working with these plants in the field. These are our lazy plums and our pillar plums, and we're looking at some of the effects. One of the things we've noticed is chlorosis in the lazy plants. We don't know exactly what's causing this, but one thing we have discovered, if you saw Jessica Waite's talk yesterday, is that these genes, the TAC and lazy genes, are responsive to photosynthesis. So they seem to be tied to light signaling and photosynthesis. We have no idea how this is integrated, but it looks like that those light response and photosynthesis pathways are regulating somehow the gravitropic responses. So this makes for a very complicated situation in terms of what's happening in the field of plant architecture. Okay, another gene that we've been looking at is WEEP. Weeping peach trees, we found, don't have a gravitropic response. So if you reorient them, they don't really bend. They just continue to grow, and they'll grow downward. They continually grow downward. We don't know much about this gene. It's an unknown protein. It's a single copy gene in most of the plant genomes that we've looked at. Again, it's quite ancient. We have no idea what it does. But when we knock it out in plum, we get this sort of altered orientation of the shoots. So we do know that it's playing a role, but at this point, we don't really know where it is. Okay. Back to APRIL control. Okay, so the other way we've been studying this and this project is, again, to try to look at this phenomena from a different perspective. And what we've done is essentially designed an RNA-seq experiment to try to get at, are there differences, or what are the differences between an apical shoot and lateral shoots at different positions? So in this case, we've gone with young saplings, essentially, that have first-order branches, and we sampled branches from the apical, upper, middle, and lower parts of the tree. And we've done this, so we have about 4 or 5 replicates for each of these. All the plants came from one segregating population, so they're all siblings, and we genetically picked out the ones that were homozygous for the pillar mutation or the weeping mutation or ones that were standard. And so we could compare all these to try to get a handle on what's going on in terms of at least the genetic programming, the gene expression programs in these different positions. So I'll try to summarize this data here. Let's see how I'm doing on time. Okay. It's very complicated data set because it involves different mutants, different branch positions. So I'll try to explain this as simply as possible. if we just compare lateral branches, so forget the apicals, we compare upper, middle, and lower branches. In a standard pillar or weeping tree, we essentially don't see really any significant differences. We get a very small number of significant genes when we do those comparisons. So the differences, at least in terms of gene expression between the shoots in these different positions, really isn't all that great. We don't see any dramatic differences. Okay. If we compare the apical shoots to laterals at different positions, then we start to see some big differences. So in a standard tree, if we compare the apicals to the lower shoots, we see a relatively large number of genes. And in the middle and upper shoots, we see fewer. And there's quite a bit of overlap between these as well. But we get this pretty dramatic difference in terms of apical shoots versus everything else. So there's something unique about the apical in this case. In the pillar trees, actually what we saw was it didn't seem to matter too much where the position was. The apical shoot showed similar in terms of numbers of differentially expressed genes, it was similar regardless of the branch position. And in the weeping case, we found basically nothing, so which is maybe not unexpected. So there really isn't a true apical in a weeping shoot, and so we don't really see any differences. Now, if we compare them to each other, so if we compare weeping pillar and standard trees to each other, when we compare weeping to standards or weeping apicals to pillar, we see big differences, just like we did when we compared the apicals to lower shoots in either of those trees. But if we compare standard and pillar apicals, they really didn't look to be that different from each other, so the expression profiles were quite similar. And the same was generally true in the laterals, although we did see a fairly large difference between the pillar laterals and the weep laterals. So that was the only thing that I would say was a little bit different in that case. All right, so this slide pretty much sums up all the data, and it's a bit complicated. I need to work on this. It's probably not the easiest thing to look at. So what I'm going to try to do is just point out the highlights of this. So on the top here, we have all of our samples from pillar weeping and standard trees from different branch positions. And over here are all the genes. So this is a cluster analysis. The red are genes that are induced. The blue are genes that are repressed. On the bottom, what I've done here is I've kind of color-coded the samples according to whether they're an apical in red, an upper in pink, or a middle, lower, green and blue. And if you look at the data as a whole, what we see is essentially two kind of opposite programs happening. So we see a small number of genes induced in this set while all of these are off. And in this set, we see a small number that are off and a whole bunch that are on. And then we see some that are kind of in between somewhere. So if we look at the distribution of our samples, we see on this side is a lot of green and blue, and on this side is most of the red and pink. So what we're getting to some extent is this sort of what looks to be almost a switch of some kind, in that our genetic program for apicals and upper laterals, and it's not uniform. So we do see some green and blues over here as well, and we see these are actually the weeping. So the weeping distribution does not fit this pattern. It's really only the standards and pillars that really fit this. So this was quite surprising. We really didn't expect this. One surprising thing about it is that in the apicals, we see the small number of genes induced and a whole bunch turned off. And in the laterals, we see a lot of stuff turned on. So wouldn't necessarily have thought that would be the case, but it looks like that's what's going on. I wish I could tell you what this program, this is about 1,000 genes. I've spent a lot of time looking at these, and I can't really find anything to report in terms of hormone responses or pathways or really anything all that interesting. It's a lot of unknown genes, a lot of things that don't really have any clear connections to any of the cellular processes that we're familiar with. So we're still digging through this. And again, it kind of reflects what we found before, which was in terms of finding specific genes, is we're into unknown stuff here, it looks like, in terms of the cellular or the physiological and genetic processes that are involved in controlling the architecture. So with that, I'll just quickly summarize. We know that tree shape is regulated by genes now that predominantly function in gravity response, but they are themselves regulated by light and photosynthesis. And we really don't know anything about the functions of these proteins at this point. We see these differences in expression profiles in the apical and upper shoot tips, which is something we're now trying to validate out in the field. So we hope to do that in the next year. We have these potentially mutants that have some alterations in this. So we hope to continue to use this system to try to dig more into these processes and uncover exactly how these things are working. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll thank my collaborators, and specifically two postdocs, Jessica Waite, who's here, and Courtney Hollander, who's speaking in another session, who did a lot of this work. And with that, I'll stop and take questions.
Thank you.